I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear was originally broadcast in the spring of 2012. It's an important topic on government infiltration of a variety of groups and organizations. It's an interview with Kevin Zeese, and here it is. Today we're going to focus on COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence programs, which were, and definitely still are, the government infiltration of political movements. With me on the show today to discuss this topic is Kevin Zeese. He, along with Margaret Flowers, recently wrote two articles on the subject. One is called Infiltration to Disrupt, Divide, and Misdirect Are Widespread in Occupy. And the second one is called Occupy, Infiltration of Political Movements is the Norm, Not the Exception in the United States. Kevin Zeese is a lawyer and has worked on several political campaigns and even ran for the Senate from Maryland on the Green Party. He was one of the original organizers of Occupy Washington, D.C., October 2011, and is currently among the organizers of the National Occupation of Washington, D.C., which is about to begin on March 30th. Kevin Zeese, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
You recently wrote some articles about COINTELPRO, or infiltration of political groups. And the title of one of those articles was Occupy, Infiltration of Political Movements is the Norm, Not the Exception in the United States. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, well, we're active in the Occupy movement, and as a result, we've seen some infiltration of encampments around the country by various types of officials, from law enforcement to right-wing groups to political operatives from the Democratic Party. You know, all sorts of people trying to either undermine, divide, or direct the Occupy movement. And so we started to research the history of infiltration in the United States as part of that, and a part of a three-part series that we're working on. And the history in the United States is pretty deep. You can go back 100 years and find infiltration of political movements, and it's rare in the last 100 years to see political movements that have not been infiltrated by the government. It really is the norm in American history, and I think in current politics, for groups to be infiltrated so the government's at least aware of what's going on. Once they get in and decide, you know, as for intelligence gathering purpose and decide to see what's going on, then they decide what they want to do about it. It could just be gather information. That's the least annoying type of infiltration, gathering information to see what's going on. But in the history of this kind of activity, there's been much more aggressive practices. They really try to direct where the organization's going. And they will even get up to assassination. There have been cases of infiltrators leading to assassination of political leaders, particularly the Black Panther Party in the late 1960s. And this is the biggest program was known as the COINTELPRO program. COINTELPRO was a program that looked at the civil rights movement, the peace movement, the women's rights movement, liberation movements around Cuba and American Indian movement, just all sorts. You really can't think of a movement that was not infiltrated. And it includes people like Albert Einstein and Martin Luther King, people who now have monuments on or near the mall.
You know, right, right.
And so is it's a pretty widespread practice.
Does the infiltration go across the political spectrum?
Yes, a lot of it has been on progressive groups, but there have been some infiltration of KKK-type groups and American Nazi groups. And so, yes, there has been some of that, but it's a very tiny percentage of resources. But I think that there's less of those groups in comparison to political movements on the other side.
And in one of your articles that you just recently wrote, I was reading that the ratio was one agent into every six demonstrators. And maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked by that, but I shouldn't have been. There are two really good examples of this. 1968, the Democratic National Convention. There was an anti-war protest going on during the convention. And about 10 years later, documents came out that showed that one out of six of the 10,000 or so protesters who were out there were actually federal agents. In addition to those federal agents, there were probably also Chicago police. The Chicago had the Red Squad, as every city in the country had over the last 75 or so years, Red Squads that initially were going after communists, but also were used to go after political events. So 1 out of 6 there. And the reason I shouldn't have been surprised is because I worked with Peter Camejo when he was running for office as a Green in California for governor, and also when he was Ralph Nader's vice president in 2004. I served as Ralph Nader's press secretary, so I knew Peter Camejo well. He often told the story about when he ran for president as a socialist in 1976, how there were break-ins into their offices, and they were able to get the FBI in court alleging Counterpro-type activities. And in court, the judge asked the special agent in charge, how many FBI agents do you have working in the Camejo campaign? And the answer was 66. Camejo estimated that he had about 400 campaign workers. That was 1 out of 6 of the people working in his campaign were FBI agents. And the judge ordered the FBI to leave within 30 days. Camejo then ordered that no one be fired, no one be allowed to quit, and no one be allowed to go on vacation over the next 30 days. And so we wanted to see who the agents were. Turned out one of them was the campaign co-chair. So these agents can get in not only in large numbers, but they get in deep. They become, when I got out of law school, my initial work was in ending the drug war, and I worked with a lot of police officials who used to be drug enforcement officials. And they described their job was, when they got in, was to make themselves indispensable, make themselves people who were relied on, people who did a lot of key work, so that when things happened, they were the go-to person and become the best friend of the leadership. And that's kind of what sounds like happened in the Camejo campaign. He got to be campaign co-chair of a presidential campaign who was actually an FBI agent.
Wow. Now, can these agents come from the military, local police, everywhere?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we looked at a number of specific cases, and we were very interested particularly in occupations because we were working in the Occupy movement. And so the most recent really large occupation in Washington, D.C. was just after Dr. King was killed. In May of 1968, there was a Resurrection City, which was an encampment on the Washington, D.C. Mall. And the FBI was heavily involved in infiltrating. They had not only people in the Resurrection City, but they also had people pretending to be press, coming to press conferences. They had people acting as just tourist types outside of Resurrection City, just around the area, just talking to people as they came and went. That was the largest area of infiltration. But the second largest area of infiltration of Resurrection City was the military. The military was aggressively involved in infiltrating Resurrection City, and they were using all sorts of high-tech devices to record and capture information going in and out that they would share with the 6 or so other police forces that were involved in monitoring Resurrection City. I know when we were in Washington, D.C. for Occupy Washington, D.C., I don't think we had the military, but certainly Homeland Security was involved in both working with us when we did protest, but I assume also monitoring our activities.
And I know there were a lot of homeless people in the Occupy movement that joined the Occupy in different cities and became sort of a problem for some of the groups. Do you think that they may have been sent there on purpose, or were they infiltrated?
Well, there were definitely reports of homeless folks being sent into the Occupy. Not only homeless folks, but also police in New York were reportedly sending some of the people they knew were problem people, mentally ill, criminal element types, into Zuccotti Park to cause trouble there. We had some homeless people working with us in Washington, D.C. Some were very good, by the way. So just like with any category with this, I think one of the most important rules of dealing with infiltration is, first, don't get paranoid and assume everybody's an infiltrator. And second, don't accuse people of being infiltrators. Instead, focus on what they do. And I'd say the same thing to the homeless community. We had some very good homeless activists in Freedom Plaza, and so this is not a broad brush comment on homeless folks. But there has been a tradition in many cities of using homeless to gather information about criminal activity. They're on the street. They see what's going on. They're usually in poorer neighborhoods where crime is more common because people are more desperate. And so they became informants generally in policing. And we suspect that there were definitely homeless people who were sent into the camps to disrupt. They would be at the General Assembly raising issues about where's the money, what was the money spent on, all this kind of causing disruptions. You know, where are the free Metro cards? It was a big fight in New York City, always at the General Assemblies, or not always, but often at the General Assemblies. So that does happen as well. So homeless folks are low cost. You could probably, a pack of cigarettes or $20 will be enough to get a night of disruption of a General Assembly.
Wow. So what are some of the other signs to look for? I know you said sometimes they'll get rowdy or try and disrupt the meetings. Are there other signs that people can look for?
Yeah, well, as I said, first, there are different kinds of infiltrators. And in fact, the final article we're going to be doing, we've done two parts so far. The first article talked about how widespread is infiltration in the Occupy movement. We did a survey of occupiers, talked to occupiers. We traveled along the West Coast to meeting with occupiers out there and getting a sense of how common this was. We found it was very common, by the way. Second article that we've kind of talked about already is the history of infiltration. The third article is going to be about how to deal with it. And part of that is spotting infiltrators. And as I said, the most important thing is not really to look for the infiltrator, but look for actions. And the common actions would be to get in close. Some will go in quietly, become part of the community, become friends with people, become doing a certain function, just becoming a reliable member of the community. Then down the road, they can take actions of various sorts to direct where the community is going, what the community is considering, and relay information back to the police. So that's one aspect, is getting in close. Second, it's very common for infiltrators to want to get information like financial information. And they want to get this for a couple reasons. First, it's useful information for the opponents of the political movement, but also it's a useful way to cause divisions. Money is a great divider. What did that money get spent on? Where did that money come from? Who decided that money got spent? Why don't we spend the money on this? Why don't we spend the money on that? And you can cause all sorts of divisions by fighting over money. Another very common area of infiltration activity is getting involved in the media, so they can become the person who communicates to the media about the message and thereby give out the message they want to give out rather than what the Occupy wants to give out. And in these days, of course, that means not just talking to the press, which is a more challenging area for the infiltrator to get to, but can be done. But more common is taking over social media like Facebook pages or web pages or Twitter accounts, and then using those to direct. In Phoenix, for example, at the Occupy in Phoenix, they had a very open policy as far as allowing people to be administrators of their website. And one of the administrators erased all of the videos that were taken, live stream video library that they had stored on the website that was going to be used actually to defend people who were arrested to show actually what happened in the arrest. All of that was erased. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, somebody took control of their email network, made it into an announcement-only email, and when the occupiers were faced with a police action to close the camp, they put out a message saying that Lancaster occupiers decided to leave voluntarily and peaceably. In fact, there were 30 occupiers who were ready to stand and risk arrest, to force the police to arrest them if they were going to close the camp, and the General Assembly had not decided to leave without resistance, and of course, nonviolent resistance. And so getting that out to their network of occupiers and to the media was a way for this infiltrator to totally undermine and confuse, and as a result, there was no resistance to the police when they decided to close the camp.
Is this legal, this kind of infiltration by the military?
Some is and some isn't. Of course, you're in a public park, and so anyone can be in a public park, and so that's one aspect of it. But there are definitely parts that are not legal. It's certainly not legal for the military to be involved in this kind of activity, and that was not even legal when it was happening in Resurrection City back in those days. And it's also not legal for infiltrators to be urging serious criminal activity. That's going way beyond as well. So there are clear violations there. And, of course, our constitutional rights have been so filled with holes. Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or right to assemble to redress grievances. There are lots of laws that restrict our freedom of speech and our right to assembly. No searches without probable cause or search warrant, of course, that happens every day throughout the country constantly to the point of pat-down searches regularly occurring by TSA officials and others. And so the Constitution makes these grand statements, but there's a lot of weaknesses in them and a lot of exceptions. And in fact, I think we've gotten to the point now where the exceptions are the rule on almost all these constitutional rights that we're supposed to have.
Yes, that's really very frightening. Now, I understand that you are one of the founders or original organizers of the Occupy Washington, D.C. back in October, and you're starting up another occupation starting, I think, March 30th?
That's right. We're starting, beginning March 30th, the National Occupation of Washington, D.C. It's going to go for the month of April. It's not going to be an ongoing occupation, but a one-month activity, and we will be having a wide range of activities. People can read the details at nowdc.org. And we're going to be covering things like we're going to be having a social forum, which is an educational event that brings occupiers together to talk about a wide range of issues, not just policy issues, what's the solution to healthcare, what's the solution to banking, but also, more importantly, I think, sharing experiences about what has worked, what hasn't worked, what kind of strategy makes sense to achieve our goals, what kind of tactics work with those strategies. How do we work with labor more effectively? There's been positive and negative experiences of working with labor on both sides, labor side and occupy side. What do we learn from that? So building the movement with a lot of knowledge-based activities through occupiers sharing information. We'll have a full-day conference called Controlling the Corporation, which will be talking about what strategies and tactics to weaken corporate rule and take control of our lives. There'll be lots of actions. The first day we have an action called Occupy the EPA, which is on March 30th, and that's going to have speakers. It's going to have alpacas, a pack of alpacas. In fact, nationally award-winning alpacas. We're going to have a big blow-up Earth and a polar bear puppet, and we're going to be calling for the EPA to enforce clean air laws and protect the environment rather than protect corporate interests who want to profit at the expense of the environment. And so that'll be an exciting day. Helen Caldicott, who's a long-term anti-nuclear activist, Ralph Nader will both be speaking, as will Marsha Coleman Adebayo, who is a EPA whistleblower, Margaret Flowers, who's a single-payer healthcare activist. So it's going to be a pretty interesting day of protecting the planet for a sustainable future. That's the first protest. There's other protests already planned. The first weekend, there'll be a Occupy Department of Education challenging the abuse of testing and how those tests are used to privatize and close down public schools. There'll be an Occupy Department of Justice action later in the month focused on mandatory sentencing and political prisoners and privatization of prisons. And there's a direct action working group that's developing a whole bunch of other actions as well. In the middle of the month, April 14th and 15th, we're going to have OccuFest, a celebration of Occupy power, both music and art and political speech and spoken word, talking about political issues that the Occupy is concerned about. And that's going to be a two-day event in Meridian Hill Park on 16th Street in Washington. So a lot going on. I really urge people to come down and participate. If they can come down for a weekend, come down for a week, come down for a few days, they should come to Washington in April. It's going to go from March 30th to the end of the month. And really, I think it's a real chance to uplift the Occupy movement to a new level of activity.
Wow, it sounds really great. What day is the Control the Corporation going to be?
Controlling the Corporations is on April 2nd. That's going to be the first major educational event that we'll be having, and it's going to be a full-day event going from 8:30 till 5. The details are on the Now DC website under the Educational Activities and the Social Forum, and got a great group of speakers who are participating, so it'll really be a great event.
Yeah. Now, I'm assuming that you're going to be infiltrated on this event, it sounds like.
We may already be. You know, we have about a 45-person or 40-person group that's meeting and involved in trying to organize this event. And you can't tell from these telephone calls who's who all the time. I don't know everybody for sure. And so I expect they probably already are infiltrators.
Wow. And so how do you deal with that? You just kind of go forward and look for signs? And
Well, you go forward and you start to put in protections. Like, for example, while everybody has the ability to post on our Facebook page, there's only a couple of administrators. While everybody has the ability to post on our website, there's only a few administrators there. Same thing with our Twitter account. And so you limit the access. And we discussed these kind of issues openly because there was one occupation that ended up not endorsing it, but they wanted to have every occupation should have two people with administrative privileges on the website. That would have been a disaster. And we decided that we didn't want to go that way. And so we decided not to give them that. And that, as a result, they didn't join the occupation. My suspicion is that that occupation has been heavily infiltrated and that they were being pushed that way by people who are manipulating them to think that they needed that kind of power as part of Occupy DC.
Wow. So this is a really effective technique that the government uses to...
They've perfected this over the years. This is not some, you know, hey, let's try this. This is something they've done as a tactic, a strategy with specific tactics under it for decades. They know what they're doing. They do it with intention. And we just have to expect it. As I said, you know, it's very important not to be paranoid about it. We don't want to get off track of our mission of building an independent movement that will challenge the corporate power and the structures that hold political power in place. That's our mission, and we're going to stay with that, and we're not going to get off track of that, and we're not going to be paranoid about this issue. We're going to put in place principles that deal with issues like people coming to a general assembly and disrupting. We'll have principles that don't allow that, and so that can be dealt with when it occurs. We'll have principles against people gossiping and doing negative conversation about others rather than talking to them directly, because that's a very common divisive tactic. We're cautious about who can have total access to the administrative privileges on our social media, who can talk to the media and what they can say. And so you have all these kinds, put these kinds of things in place and you move forward and do your work. And so that's just part of the process of organizing in the freest country on earth.
Okay. Yeah, getting less free all the time. But now, do corporations have infiltrators going out? Do you know?
Corporations have developed very professional security systems. I would very much expect that they would have this kind of activity going on. I was involved in a project called Stop the Chamber, which was focused on the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is about the biggest corporate bully in Washington, D.C. They do most of the dirty work of the corporations lobbying in D.C. They're really very aggressive at it. And we, thanks to Anonymous, we discovered that there was a plan by a private security firm, H.B. Gary, working with a big corporate law firm in Washington, D.C., who works for the Chamber of Commerce, Hunton and Williams, and they were planning a campaign against us. What happened was H.B. Gary made the mistake of attacking Anonymous and saying they were going to expose Anonymous' leaders, which is just absurd on its face since there are no leaders in Anonymous. But they were going to expose Anonymous' leaders, and Anonymous attacked them instead and downloaded 70,000 emails of their CEO. And in those emails was a plan to go after critics of the Chamber of Commerce with a cybersecurity campaign that would have been an attack on with creating fake websites and fake website email personalities, sock puppets to give us false documents, undermine our credibility. By then we publish the false documents and we lose our credibility. Monitoring our children, you know, all sorts of stuff was being planned. And thankfully that got exposed before it was able to take root.
Now, is there anything that we can do to prevent this, that citizens can do to try and curb this or prevent it?
Well, I think it's most important for citizens not to be afraid of it. What we are all doing is legal, and the kinds of civil resistance activities that we engage in are minor, essentially going where we're not supposed to go, saying what we're not supposed to say, and refusing to leave when we're told to leave. That's pretty much the extent of our criminal activity. And so that's not anything very serious. And almost always you can do organizing without any violations of law at all. And we can even do things that we're not supposed to go and saying what I was supposed to say, and even then not being arrested. So I think it's very important for people not to be afraid of this. I think that they should be recognized that the best way to combat this is to get involved and to participate and show that the public is getting organized and mobilized. I think that really is what it's going to take to change this culture enough so that we can get the kinds of policies we want, policies that represent the interests of the people as opposed to the concentrated wealth that dominates the government right now. That's what we're fighting against. We're fighting against essentially an oligarchic system where the most wealthy people and most wealthy corporations in the country control government and write laws on their behalf. And you can see that in the tax structure. You can see that in so many different ways. And so people need to get organized, get educated, and get mobilized in order to take back the country and make it a country of by and for the people, not of by and for the wealthy.
I was just reading about a law that was passed recently by Congress and signed by the president that limits our ability to demonstrate a protest by saying that we couldn't stand so many feet near where there was an elected official who had Secret Service around them.
Yeah, that's a new law that essentially if the Secret Service is protecting somebody, that becomes an area where you can't protest, which we think is actually designed exactly for the Occupy. There have been some instances where presidential candidates and other political candidates were being mic-checked, essentially the audience start talking in unison about a position they hold of some kind, and that's the kind of thing that they like to forbid. But all it does is create essentially a trespass law, which is a minor misdemeanor, and it's not a gigantic criminal offense. So again, I would not let people be afraid. I think people need to see this as a reason to stand up. In fact, what I think it shows is that the government's afraid of the people, and I think that means we're making progress. So I think that this people should stand up and feel confident and stand up in unison, and we do that in a mobilized way. I think that they can't stop us.
Right. I agree with you on that. And so Could you tell us your website again if people want to get involved
sure.
in your D.C. event?
Well, I recommend two websites. Now D.C. is the National Occupation of Washington, D.C. It's nowdc.org. And if you want to get kind of updates on what's happening in the Occupy movement, particularly from a D.C. perspective, OccupyWashingtonDC.org covers that activity. And so I think those sites will get you pretty involved in what's going on the Occupy movement. If you're just interested in economic issues and the unfair economy, our economic website is It's Our Economy, and that's itsoureconomy.us.
Oh, I'll have to check that one out. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, we cover all sorts of economic issues there. And one thing you might find interesting in it is on the anniversary of the Powell memo, we published that memo. It was a 1971 memo by Lewis Powell, who at the time was a tobacco lawyer in Richmond but active with the Chamber of Commerce. And this is the time when the Weathermen were bombing banks and Ralph Nader was young and the Black Panthers were and the Civil Rights Movement and the Peace Movement and the Women's Rights Movement were all kind of taking power and really building up a great deal of momentum. And Lewis Powell wrote a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce laying out a plan for how corporations could take back the government and take control. And it not only talked about the courts and elected officials, but also talked about taking over control of universities, taking control of journals, the media, anything that kind of shaped power. And he laid out a plan. And it's been that plan over the last 40 years that's been instituted that has been put in place in order to take corporate power and the stranglehold we're stuck in. So if you go to It's Our Economy, look up Powell Memo, you can read about that. And then on OccupyWashingtonDC.org, we have also a discussion of the Powell Memo. If you search Powell Memo there, you'll find an article by Bill Moyers of Bill Moyers Journal on public TV. And he talks about what happened after the Powell Memo was written, how the corporate powers began to mobilize to put it in place, and the kind of meetings they held with AT&T and CBS and ABC and General Electric and other big corporations to plan to implement the Powell Memo. And then it went on to grow the Chamber of Commerce, double it in size, go from 75 or so corporate lobbyists to 18,000 corporate lobbyists in Washington, D.C. today to really build an infrastructure of corporate power with institutions like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, all that kind of stuff, to really control the direction the country's going. So this has been a long-term, 40-year plan put in place by corporate powers. Lewis Powell, by the way, 2 months after he wrote the memo, was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court by Richard Nixon.
Wow. Sounds like a conspiracy to me.
Sounds like a plan.
It is a plan. I'm joking.
Certainly a plan.
Yes. Well, Kevin, I'm imagining you must be really busy with March 30th just around the corner.
That's right.
I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me today. Thank you for being on the show.
Okay. Happy to do it.
You've just been listening to an interview with Kevin Zeese, who recently co-authored with Margaret Flowers two articles, with a third coming out soon, on COINTELPRO, which is the all-too-frequent occurrence of government infiltration of political movements. Kevin is a lawyer, has run for the Senate on the Green Party ticket, and is currently one of the organizers of the national occupation of Washington, D.C., beginning March 30th. To read the two articles on COINTELPRO and to learn about the Occupy DC event beginning March 30th, the website is nowdc.org. The 9/11 Truth Movement is heavily infiltrated. In fact, Cass Sunstein, one of Obama's closest confidants, currently head of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, co-wrote a paper in 2008 while at Harvard Law School proposing that the U.S. government employ teams of covert agents as pseudo-independent advocates to cognitively infiltrate online groups, websites, and activist groups like the 9/11 Truth Movement, which Sunstein thinks holds false conspiracy theories about the government. David Ray Griffin wrote about Cass Sunstein's cognitive infiltration paper in his book called Cognitive Infiltration, an Obama Appointee's Plan to Undermine the 9/11 Conspiracy Theory. It's actually a great read. I would encourage you to check it out. And finally, I want to remind you that this evening, Wednesday, March 21st, we'll be showing the movie A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995. A Noble Lie is the culmination of years of research and documentation conducted by independent journalists, scholars, and ordinary citizens. Often risking their personal safety and sanity, they have gathered evidence which threatens to expose the startling reality of what exactly occurred at 9:02 a.m. on April 19, 1995, in Oklahoma City. Come and learn about the similarities between the Oklahoma City bombing and 9/11. The time is 7 p.m., and it'll be in the Auerbach Auditorium on the campus of the University of Hartford. And again, that's today, March 21st. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.